Of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's program. 50 years later, human rights and social reconstruction in Africa. We're honored to have with us this evening three knowledgeable speakers. Patrick Vink is the director of the Initiative for Vulnerable Populations Project at UC Berkeley's Human Rights Center. Annie Holmes and Peter Orner are co-editors of the book Hope Deferred, Narratives of Zimbabwean Lives. I'm Chuck Frankel. I'm a trustee of the World Affairs Council. And for full disclosure, I represent the country of Botswana as its honorary consul. A quick word about the council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of informed actions. To learn more about how to get involved with the council and support our mission, please refer to the card on your chair or visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org. When you cannot attend a program, you can still stay informed by accessing the Council's podcasts and streaming audio and online video. The Council programs can also be heard on the weekly one-hour radio show called It's Your World. It airs every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on National Public Radio, KQED 88.5 FM. And tonight's program is being recorded for future broadcast. I just want to thank our audio engineer, Jane Heaven, for recording tonight's program. Before we begin, please take a moment to turn off your cell phones and any other noise-making devices you may have. And while you do that, I'd like to take the opportunity to mention that registration for World Affairs 2011, the Council's annual conference, is now open. World Affairs 2011, Challenges to American Power, is an opportunity for you to connect with thought leaders and engaged peers on the most critical issues of our day. The conference begins the evening of Friday, March 18th, with the Take Action reception and opening keynote addresses by Robert Reich and Fareed Zakaria. And then on Saturday from 8 to 5, we will continue with exceptional keynotes, in-depth conversations, and rich networking opportunities. Tickets are now available on the Council's website, so I urge you to sign up for that. It's coming soon. James Wolfenson will be our guest speaker on January 11th as part of the Guggenheim Speaker Series event. The former president of the World Bank will discuss in dialogue his remarkable life story, reflect on his time at the World Bank, and share his thoughts on the future of global poverty. The event will take place at the Herbst Theater, 6:30 p.m., and that's January the 11th. Lastly, I'd encourage you all to make use of the blue question cards that have been placed on your seats. Please write your questions legibly and succinctly, and hand the cards to Council staff members. Audience questions will be posed to our speaker during the second half of our program. It's now my honor to introduce our distinguished guests this evening. Patrick Vink is the director and co-founder of the Initiative for Vulnerable Populations at UC Berkeley's Human Rights Center, as well as the co-founder of COBO, a digital data collection project to advance human rights research. Mr. Vink serves as a member of the Committee on Scientific Freedom and Responsibility of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He is an adjunct associate professor at Tulane University's Payson Center for International Development and a regular consultant on vulnerability analysis to the United Nations World Food Program and to the World Bank. Peter Orner is the author of The Second Coming of Mavela Shikongo and Esther Stories. He is also the editor of the Voices of Witness book, Underground America, an oral history of undocumented people living in the U.S. A 2006 Guggenheim Fellow, Mr. Orner is an associate professor at San Francisco State University. And Annie Holmes, who was born in Zambia and raised in Zimbabwe, is now a documentary filmmaker and a writer who has published short fiction both in the U.S. and Africa. She has written a memoir about Zimbabwean independence entitled Good Red. And now here to discuss how African populations are dealing with human rights abuses, ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming in their speaking order Patrick Vink, and then Annie Holmes and Peter Orner.
Thank you very much for the introduction and for the opportunity to talk about the Central African Republic. I hope my accent will not create any misunderstanding, and sometimes I make up words that do not exist, so please forgive me for that. It's always a pleasure in some strange way, perhaps, to talk about the situation in the Central African Republic, mainly because it is such a forgotten place, such a place that we do not hear about, a place where information is seldom available, and the issues that people face on a daily basis are not documented. The idea of our project in the Central African Republic and elsewhere, mostly in the Central African region, including Uganda and the Congo, is really about giving a voice to the population and understanding what people have experienced during conflict, post-conflict, but also understanding how that affects them on a daily basis, how it affects mental health, perception of institutions like the government, their sense of security, access to services, a range of impacts that are typically associated with mass violence. And perhaps more importantly, ask people about what they would like to see happen. What are their priorities? How do they think peace can be built? What do they think should be done for the victims? One of the main interesting, at least for us, aspect of this work is that those questions are never raised with victims or survivors of violence. Very seldom do we ask them, what do you think needs to be done to have peace? We ask them about how much food they have. We ask them about whether the water is clean and how far it is, but we don't ask them those very, very basic questions. So we started this project about 5 years ago, and the Central African Republic was a country that came to our focus for a few reasons. First, it was, selected as a case country for the International Criminal Court. So there are investigations ongoing in the Central African Republic. But a key question for us was really, when we focus on a country, what are the gaps of information? If we go and do research in these countries, will that information be new information? Will that be information be of interest for the people who work in the Central African Republic? And will people actually do something with that information? And I have to say, in the Central African Republic, we probably had the best, or at least most supportive, result that we ever could expect. There are so few groups, so few people working on that country, that any kind of data that we could bring was seen as being very, very positive. So we went there, and we did what we always do, which is a combined approach, a multi-method approach, in which we do interviews, in-depth interviews, to kind of identify the main issues that we should be working on. And then we do a quantitative survey, kind of a large poll. We interviewed nearly 2,000 people on those issues, the past, what has happened to them, the present, how it affects them, and the future, what they would like to see happen. What did we find? First is the extent of the violence. I had to have some of that statistics in front of me, but basically there is a full page of different aspects of violence that people can experience, from witnessing violence to direct experience to indirect violence, like something happened to their family members. And what we see is that virtually everyone has experienced some form of violence, the most common one being displaced, losing assets due to the conflict. Fewer, but still significant, people who, for example, have witnessed violence, beating, about half the population. People who have witnessed killing, 30% will tell us we have witnessed killing. Those have long-term impacts in terms of the mental health of the people. So there is this ongoing violence and different patterns of violence. Some people who have mostly witnessed, some people who have been abducted, for example. And this creates really different experiences of the conflict. And as we'll see, these different experiences of the conflicts can affect how people see the present situation and what they would like to see happen as well. Everyone in our questionnaire, we ask people, do you consider yourself a victim of the conflict? And the result is about 93% who will say, yes, we are a victim of the conflict. The areas that we worked on have been affected by conflicts for many, many years, but mostly we focused on the period that started in 2002-2003. And that was the focus of the latest series of coup and emergence of militarized groups throughout the country. You have at present more than a dozen different armed groups operating in the country. Outside of the capital, Bangui, there is few, if any, government presence and services that are available to the population. What that translates into is not only the ongoing violence, but it's also the lack of services, the lack of access to healthcare, lack of access to education. Anecdotally, I can tell you about the schools that we visited that look more like stables. There is no infrastructure. The teachers in some provinces, less than 10% of the primary school teacher are actually qualified state-paid teachers. 90% are parents who just volunteer their time or get a small payment from the other parents in order to teach whatever they can teach the children. Again, you can see the long-term impact of that type of services available to the population in the Central African Republic. The ongoing violence has an impact on the services, but also on the basic livelihood of the people. We ask people to rank their safety in a range of situations, and few people feel safe walking at night in their village, going to the next village, going to the market, going to their field. So the violence has a direct impact on what people experience, but it also has an impact on their livelihoods, how they can operate in the country. It really challenged their basic access to food and their field and their productive life. Another element that we found is the link between conflict violence and domestic violence. And we see that people who have experienced more conflict-related violence experience are more likely to experience domestic violence as well. Again, these have long-term implication on the people who live in the Central African Republic. And lastly, in terms of the past, what people have experienced is the issue of the mortality. We've written a little bit more on the issue of mortality because it was really surprising to us both the level of the mortality among the people in the Central African Republic, which was as high as it has been in the Central Africa, in the Darfur or in Eastern Congo, if not higher, but also that it was so high even in areas that are not currently affected by conflict. And so what this shows is that the impact of violence is not just limited to the areas affected by conflict, but there is a broader structural issue that leads to a condition where people are dying at a very, very fast pace. So this is the situation in which people live. Let's look a little bit more prospective, what can happen, what should happen. And really what we asked first was, in your opinion, what are the root causes of the conflict? And what people told us, it's about fighting for power. 66%. This is what the root causes of the conflict is. And that really reflects the responses when we ask people, when you're in your opinion, what should be done to have peace. And what they talk about is about political dialogue. It's about having elections. These are the most common answer. And the last one is about the demobilization of the combatants. Those are very different answers than we could expect in other countries. I mean, in Uganda, for example, people talk about unity, about services, healthcare, development. But in the Central African Republic, it's mostly about these political issues, dialogue. I'll focus first on this issue of the former combatants. These DDR programs, demobilization, disarmament, reintegration programs, are very common. And very often they are taken from the perspective of the combatants. What we did here was ask the community, how would you feel in the presence of former combatants in a range of situations? Would you feel comfortable with a former combatant living in your village? Would you feel comfortable with a former combatant sharing a drink with you? Would you feel comfortable with your children going to the same school as a former combatant or the children of a former combatant? And what we see is very, very negative feelings. So when you approach these kind of programs, it's not only about the combatants, it's not only about the government side, but it's about the people. How do we work with the communities so that we have a more likely, higher likelihood of success in reintegration of these former combatants? And that's really what this project is about, creating that dialogue, creating that interaction with the populations that we understand their priorities, understand what they are feeling, and start discussing that. We also asked people whether they thought that peace was at all possible, whether it was possible for all the people of the Central African Republic to live together in peace, and whether it was possible for the Central African Republic to live in peace with other countries. And we got about half the people who say, yes, it is possible. In northern Uganda, we get about 80%. So we have very strong pessimism, and that's, of course, related to what people have experienced, but also the 40 years of conflicts that have affected the country. I mentioned the dialogue as being a key issue of, or at least a primary way that people see out of the conflict and towards peace. And political dialogue being the main answer. I'll get back to this in a minute, because we talk to people about accountability and what they would like to see happen to those who are responsible for the violence. And the responses were, punish them, have them face trial, kill them. 90% of the answer were in those punitive terms. We then asked them, well, in your opinion, who should be held accountable for the violence? And there was a range of actors that were mentioned. Among them, the two most common answers, each mentioned by about 30% of the people, were current President Bozize and former President Patase. The next elections are going to be mostly fought between current President Bozize and former President Patase. Which means that when we talk about elections, dialogue, political changes, we are confronted here with a situation that's very unlikely to change, at least from this perspective. Lastly, before concluding on this, we asked the people what they thought should be done for the victims. And their answer were mostly framed in terms of individual compensation. We would like to be restituted what we have lost. We'd like to receive financial compensation. We'd like to receive cattle, houses. There is an international human rights to reparation for what people have experienced, and we believe that's very much part of what needs to happen in the Central African Republic in terms of rebuilding hope among the population. Lastly, what we have found across country, and that is consistent over time, is the interest in the population in finding out what has happened and why it has happened, establishing the truth. And this is really something that we also see as an important part of what should happen, not only in the Central African Republic, but in other places where we have worked, in Uganda or in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It's probably the single most consistent element across all of the places we have worked. I talked about accountability and punitive mechanism. In Uganda, we have very, very different answers. People want to see people come out of the bush. We should forgive, forget in a much more frequent way. But in the Central African Republic, it's about accountability. The one element that is consistent is that aspect of finding out the truth, what has happened, why it has happened. So we see this as the way forward. As I mentioned, there definitely needs to be political dialogue and political pressure. It's unlikely that the leader will change in a major way, which means that there needs to be pressure so that progress is made in terms of developing services, developing program to reduce poverty outside of the capital, and then addressing accountability and establishing the truth on what has happened there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Patrick Vink. And now we move on from the Central African Republic to Zimbabwe, and Peter Orner and Annie Holmes with some very specific interviews that they've had in Zimbabwe.
We're going to move south on the continent to Zimbabwe. And I'm going to start by saying in Zimbabwe, in 1980, Zimbabwe was considered a jewel of Southern Africa. The country had emerged from decades of colonialism and brutal liberation struggle against the Rhodesian military to become a unified nation, one committed to democracy, reconciliation, human rights, and civil rights for all, universal education, economic development. Hope was in the air. And people throughout Southern Africa, and in apartheid South Africa in particular, were looking towards Zimbabwe as a beacon. Robert Mugabe, leader of the Zimbabwean African National Union, the ZANU Party, and a renowned freedom fighter turned statesman, had been swept into office after a landslide victory in the nation's first free elections, and was considered by many to be the ideal man to oversee Zimbabwe's emergence. Now, as you all know, Zimbabwe is a human rights disaster. Pick your statistic, Zimbabwe will be down on that list. There's been almost total economic collapse. When I was last in Zimbabwe, there was some of the highest inflation ever recorded on record. I bought a Mars bar for 50 trillion Zim dollars. Healthcare system also in free fall. Education system, once, as I mentioned, a wonderful system in the early 80s, is also in collapse now. Life expectancy in Zimbabwe is one of the lowest percentages in the world. The Zimbabwean diaspora is growing daily. The estimates vary, but certain people think 1.5 million, certain organizations, Guardian of UK has quoted 3 million people now out of the country. That's out of a population of roughly 12 million. So what happened in Zimbabwe? Our book, Hope Deferred, is an attempt to answer that question in perhaps a different way than Patrick is working in the Central African Republic. Our task, what we set out for ourselves, was to talk to people in very lengthy interviews that tried to get at who they are as individuals, not as victims of human rights violations. I think part of that comes from both Annie and myself's background as writers. We wanted to get at the totality of the person rather than just looking at them as a victim. So Annie's going to take it over now with an example of one of the people that we interviewed. We interviewed roughly about 50 people, and 25 voices made it into the book.
To start looking at the question of what has happened in Zimbabwe and why, it's a huge question. It relates to so many different elements of our history. We took the 2008 election as a kind of angle in, partly because there had been relative quiet leading up to the election in March, and there was a kind of feeling of hope. It was this window of hope for almost all Zimbabweans, I think, that perhaps we could have change through an election without as much violence as we had seen building up in the previous decade. It was something that affected everyone. Everyone we spoke to, we could ask them, where were you on the election day, March 29th, 2008? And what were your expectations? And then we could ask them, how did you get there and what happened subsequently? We didn't use that all the way through mechanically, but it did give us an angle on the violence. I think, as Peter has said, like Patrick's project, we wanted to go beyond the case study. We wanted to go beyond the things that the narrow kinds of questions that people are asked. And for me, as a Zimbabwean who's lived in the US for the last 8 or 9 years, working on the book also served my kind of stealth agenda, which was to have the voices of Zimbabweans as full, complicated, interesting human beings speaking about their issues, our issues, rather than being a three-line statistic or proof, evidence towards some kind of argument or some kind of position. So with that in mind, I want to tell you something about a woman we call Alice, because we changed almost all the names, not all of them, but most. Alice is 42 years old when we interview her. She's living in hiding in a country neighboring Zimbabwe. She stays in her safe house most of the time because she's nervous about Zimbabwean agents in the rest of the country. And she relies on Christianity and the internet to keep her from feeling quite so isolated. So just some background on what got Alice to that point. My work in politics ended up hurting one of my children, beginning in 2006. I don't want to talk about the details. I went through terrible experiences myself, but it is my family that I am thinking of. It is concern about my family that causes me the most pain. I grew up working in people's houses as a maid until I got married. By then, I already had a son. He was 2 years old when I got married. I also took care of my husband's brother's children, his sister's children, and my husband's children from his previous wife who had died. My husband worked as a TV and radio technician, but he didn't make enough money to support the family, so I became a cross-border trader, traveling to Botswana, buying goods, and going back to Zimbabwe to sell. One time when I came back from Botswana, my husband said, "Help me with some of your money so that I can go to Mozambique to open a shop. I will give you back your money as soon as I start making profits." Unfortunately for me, he found another woman there after 3 months of working in Mozambique. This was in 2006. He didn't think about me or care. We had lived together for 15 years. Even before my husband left, I had been participating in MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, for some time. But earlier, I had to do it quietly. Where I lived, people had stopped coming out in the open because an MDC chairman was badly beaten up in our area. People were afraid of getting killed. I got involved in MDC because I was unhappy about the way we were living in Zimbabwe. A lot of kids were going to school and getting educated, but with no jobs afterward. Only people in government were benefiting while others suffered. So Alice gets involved as a local level organizer, organizing rallies, taking care, and then as people start to be arrested, taking care of MDC members who are in jail, delivering food to them, taking messages. She's not a high-level player. She's a local-level organizer. But she started to get into trouble, and she had people checking up on her. She knew they were looking for her. In winter, it gets dark early. It was sometime after 6 p.m. when three cars full of people drove up to my house. This was the 7th of June, 2008. So this is after the initial election where there was a stalemate and they called for a runoff between the two presidential candidates. And at that point when the runoff was called was when the most severe political violence that we've experienced, I think, began. So there was this period in 2008 where we went from the window of hope into really devastating violence. When I heard the sound of cars, I looked through the curtain and saw that it was bad. There was nowhere to run. They were wearing army uniforms, not the militia uniforms of the Green Bombers, but camouflage, the Zimbabwean army uniform, and they were armed with guns. They all got out of the cars. Some jumped over my gate, and some went around to my neighbor's house where I used to go to hide. My house is a typical ghetto house. Each one is attached to the neighbor's house. So they surrounded my house and the neighbor's house. There was a visitor at my neighbor's house and they beat him badly, tearing the skin of his buttocks. Then they went searching in the bedrooms in my house. In the spare bedroom, they found my stepson. I'd given him the spare keys to my bedroom so that if I wasn't there, he could get anything he needed. They beat him because he could not get the door open. He was trying to insert the key, but he could not do it because I was inside holding the key. When I realized that they were beating him, I decided to unlock the door. I came out and said, "Please don't beat up my son. He has done nothing wrong. I am the problem because I am a member of MDC. They said, "Are you showing off with your MDC? I said, "No, I'm not. You are hurting someone who has done no wrong." They said, "Okay, open your bedroom. Why were you locked inside?" I said, "I was afraid because you came into my house with guns. I've never had visitors bring guns before." They went into my bedroom and started searching. They found posters and flyers and newspapers. They told me to carry all the stuff out of the house. They left my stepson and took me in their open truck, a cream Mitsubishi. I was sitting in the back, in the middle, and they were surrounding me, sitting on the sides. They were all beating me, kicking me, and hitting me with sticks and fists. Some were saying that they wanted to throw me into the dam. Another car stopped, and someone inside said, "Did you find her?" And they said, "Yes, we did." They wanted me to tell them where the MDC MPs lived, the youth's houses, the councillor's house. That's why they were beating me up, because I was refusing to tell them. They were saying, "So you are being like Jesus, who died for others, and now are you going to die for those people?" I said, "No, whoever showed you my house should have shown you all the other houses." They said I was rude. They beat me up so badly. After that, they said, "Take off your clothes." When I removed my clothes, just before we got to the Methodist church, they stopped the car in the dark, and there they raped me. There were many soldiers, sorry. I don't know how many raped me. I saw the first 8 men who raped me, but then I became unconscious. I think they threw water on me because I became conscious just before we got to the police station. They said, "Put on your clothes." I refused. They said, "You don't listen." In the end, I put on my clothes. When we got there, they said, "Get off and carry your stuff." I got off the back of the truck, but I couldn't even walk. I fell down, and they said, "Get up," and I did. Inside, when they got me behind the counter in the police station, they threw a bullet at me and said, "Kiss it," and I did. And they said, "That bullet is yours."
One of the other interviews we did, we had an opportunity to interview what, by any objective standard, would be considered a human rights perpetrator. And we felt that that would be an interview that might help the totality of understanding of the situation if we included that particular voice. It was somewhat controversial when we were putting the book together, but in the end, we decided that he was an important voice to hear. And this is Aaron. Aaron is 30 years old. He's a former soldier, now living in exile in South Africa. He'd always wanted to be a soldier since he was a kid. He used to play violent video games, and he used to love watching war movies. But his parents were dead set against him joining the military. His father had actually been involved in an early campaign of the government in the early 80s, when there was already starting to be a considerable amount of violence in Zimbabwe, unreported internationally mostly, but it was called the Kukurahundi campaign, and his father was involved in that, which basically was a campaign to root out so-called traitors in Matabele land in Zimbabwe. So his father tries to talk him out of it. His mother is involved in MDC politics, like Alice, and she also is very much against him joining the government. But this guy wants to be a soldier. He ends up being an orderly in a hospital, and then finally deciding, no, that's not what he wants to do. And this is in his own words. He says, "If you have a dream to fulfill, sometimes you have to go for it. I think that's when I made my first big blunder. This happens to everyone, especially when you're young. You end up doing the wrong thing. I think the problem was my family was making me feel like a coward. I don't ever want to look like a coward." So he joins the military, and he's in the military from 1998 to about 2008, right after the elections. He is involved in violence in the Congo, when the Zimbabwean military moved into the Congo and was involved there. All sorts of violence he saw up close. in the interview, so he finally leaves the military out of fear that his parents are going to be, particularly his mother, is going to be, there's going to be reprisals against her. So he leaves the military and flees because it's not, you know, it's not something the military wants. It's people out there who have done this and now are leaving. So he ends up in South Africa where we met him. It took him a very long time to open up to us. But finally, he started to talk about what it was like on one of these missions, which we already heard Alice describe in, from her point of view. Okay, fine, I'll tell you. Let's say it's Friday night around 10 p.m. You're soldiering. You get to this bar. Usually when you go for such missions, you prepare yourself. Maybe you use a barbed wire belt. Some guys, they use the butt of a rifle. The moment we kick open the door, the patrons are terrified. First, they're terrified even of the uniform, and secondly, we are the army. And so let's say one of you goes to talk to the owner of the bar. The rest of you, you pick from the patrons. You ask all the patrons to bring out their belongings, especially their money, everything. So you stand all the people there, and then you check on their ages. For myself, I respect people who are old. With the old ones, I always tried to persuade the others to let them go. Then, the rest, you make them dance. They're crawling on the chairs and cupboards, singing, dancing, jumping. Remember, when people are scared and terrified, they can't even dance, even though they know how to dance. It's very impossible for them to dance, so you want them to dance. You sit there and drink their beer, and yeah, you make them do it. And then maybe you say, you've all had enough? Okay, if you count to three, you all disappear from this bar. Say one, two, and the moment you get to three, one of you closes the door and says, no, no, you're too slow. So then you say, we can't let you go because this was an MDC rally that was taking place. Next time, don't make rallies in the bar. We make some of them get naked. Usually we're more interested in the women, so mostly the women undress. Then we mop the floor with their clothes. It's dark outside by then. The whole process lasts about an hour and a half. And then you open a very small door for them to all go out at the same time. It always happens. Some people get stuck, others injure themselves during the process of trying to run away.
Well, thank you very much. You certainly have set the scene and depressed us all. We have some vague understanding of the rest of the interviews that you conducted, and I think this is the starting point for a discussion. So let's ask, what the value is of both the survey that you've conducted as well as the interviews that you've conducted. Take either, who would like to start? Peter.
Thank you. It's a question we ask ourselves a lot. We want to make sure that the, I think I mentioned it earlier, we want to make sure that the information we provide is useful and that it's useful from a very practical perspective, that people are going to actually do something about the information that we provide. I can give just a few examples, focusing, for example, on trying to understand how people know and learn about accountability mechanism. About the International Criminal Court or other mechanism, how do people interact with them? How do they learn about them? And from that, really trying to understand what are the improvements that can be done. Realizing, for example, that the disenfranchised, the people who have no access to radio, media, are the ones who know the least. That seems very logical. But not only do they know the least, they're also misinformed. So there is an impact of the informal information channel that they use that actually is conducive to wrong information, and that in turn can affect what they see in their environment. We try to provide those information, for example, like I mentioned, asking people what do you think needs to be done to have peace, because that's information that's never available. And we present those results both to governments, United Nations agencies, NGOs, and try to bring that information also for advocacy, or at least to raise the profile of these issues. In the Central African Republic, as I mentioned, the country is so little known that any kind of information we were able to provide we've tried to use that so that people would actually know and realize that the Central African Republic should be on the agenda. In the last security, the General Assembly, of the UN, for the first time in many, many years, the Central African Republic was actually a topic. That's not our work, but I feel we contribute to that. I think there are many people who try to raise those issues, and that's the kind of impact we try to have. I'll add one more thing, which is also that we don't just focus on those big actors. We also go back to the communities where we work, presenting as much as we can, either through the radio or at least presenting the results to the people we interviewed, to the local leaders in the areas that we interviewed, so that they also realize what is on going on, what are the opinions of the people in the areas where they live.
Patrick, before leaving you, let me just ask, is this the basis then for some action by the International Criminal Court, or can it be, or is it background to get them involved? What's the role of the ICC?
Well, we definitely don't get them involved because they're already involved in the situation. I'm always very cautious in attributing impact. That's maybe the researcher, scientific side of our work, where we don't want to overclaim the impact that that we have. I can give a few very concrete examples. In the Central African Republic, the outreach strategy of the International Criminal Court has changed based on the outcome of the research that we have conducted. For example, raising more focus on women as a focus for outreach, because our results showed that they were the one least likely to have heard about the court, least informed about the court. And at the same time, they are so central because the one case so far concerning the Central African Republic focuses on sexual violence. So it is so important for women to hear about the court. I'll give another example from Northern Uganda, where there has been a Northern Uganda Transition Initiative, which is a fairly large program. The people who created that program told us directly that our results actually helped them identify the priorities of the program. I came from the field. I was working, as I would call it, I don't like the term, but as a development worker for a while. So it's very frustrating sometimes to be on the research side and to be producing paper, whereas I used to see buildings being made or people producing food and have a very, very concrete and direct impact. So it's always a challenge to see that, but I keep doing it because I get those feedback and feeling that it's actually making impact.
Peter, any?
Sure, yeah. First of all, human rights abuses aren't pretty, and hearing them pretty directly from the mouths of the people who experience them most isn't always a pleasurable experience. I can say that we called our book Hope Deferred because there is a deal of hope, and not every one of our stories is particularly full of all doom. But the situation is very dire in Zimbabwe, and Patrick mentioned earlier establishing truth and telling stories. And Robert Mugabe depends on you not knowing the truth about what goes on a very day-to-day basis in his country. If you asked him, he would tell you that these are, lies, and that the people are, are very happy in Zimbabwe. But part of our purpose in talking to people, and again, getting to know them, Annie and I spent days with the people that we spoke to, and I found that that people were extremely interested in sharing their stories with you all.
Do you want to add, Annie?
Briefly, I think there's room for this huge spectrum of kinds of investigation. I think they're all doing important things and in very different ways. So I think the kind of impact that this book and this series wants to produce is in the same way as good storytelling in fiction or movies or any other kind of story is to put you in a relationship with the person you're reading about in the situation and to encourage feelings of empathy. So you're not talking about some far distant, hard to imagine other kind of person. So from some kind of empathy, I think that builds towards real solidarity and feeling of working with and on behalf of and side by side with other people. So I think when you read something like this, there is so much value, as Patrick was saying, comparing Central African Republic with Uganda. I learned a lot from what you said there. That was really interesting. I think our book is a very different kind of book that asks you to compare what happened to these people with yourself as another human being. So I think there's that. And one small other note is that just the complexity of the history. It's not one enemy, one problem, one issue. So I think what comes out of our book, I hope what comes out of the book, is a kind of tapestry of different levels and tracking different kinds of issues and histories that make up the situation, because I think that complexity of understanding can only be helpful.
You said that Mugabe really doesn't want us to know the stories of these people, and that they create empathy, they create sympathy, they create concern. And then what? Here is an audience of over 100 people at the World Affairs Council, and they've, let's assume they will have read your book by next week. What happens then? What do they do about it?
This comes up. We've done a couple events already. The book just came out a couple of days ago, and this question is often answered. And I think it's a particularly wonderful thing about Americans that we want to know what to do, how we can help. I think that's a great thing. I think from our point of view, it starts with, first of all, knowing that Zimbabwe is different than the Central African Republic and what's going on in northern Uganda, that Africa is not a monolith, that these are countries with very individual and very distinct, unique histories that need to be understood, and the people on the ground need to be heard. Now, you all can't go to Zimbabwe and, like Annie and I did, and talk to people for days at a time, but, you know, that was our notion. So hopefully with this information, you know, the first step is knowledge, I think. And the second step is very practical. There are things you could do. You can pressure South Africa, for instance, which has a lot at stake in Zimbabwe's implosion, and they should be doing more, for instance. So, you know, pressuring the South African embassy, things like that. Very practical things you can start to do. But I think before we get there, before we rush to write our congressman, which you should all do, is having the background and understanding the conflict and the complexity of the conflict, I think, is an important step.
And Patrick, am I correct that in your booklet on the survey, you do have recommendations of what should be done at various levels? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. We typically provide recommendations both to government, or actually not both, but to the government, UN agencies, NGOs, both international and national NGOs. What we try to do with these surveys is not to over-interpret what the people are telling us. The idea is to represent their voice. It's not for us to give our opinion about what should be done. So the recommendations in many ways sometimes may feel a little general, but we feel that going and giving very prescriptive, detailed recommendation would be going too far in interpreting what people tell us. What are the key recommendations that I can give from the overall studies? And there are specific recommendations in the report, and each report has obviously different recommendations. But one that is key is that understanding of the heterogeneity of the population. You can't talk about, I think you mentioned earlier, not everybody's victims. I mean, in many ways, everybody experiences the conflict, and they experience the conflict in different ways. It also means that people have different expectations. Our results show that based on specific characteristics, socioeconomic status, what you have experienced during the conflict, for example, you will want to move on and forget, or you will want accountability. We try to understand this, for example, people who have been displaced but have little other experience of the conflict, the main thing that they want to do is go back home and resume their life. The people who have been tortured, who have been, and people are very open about their experience. I think that's what your stories show is too, is that people actually are willing to talk. People who have experienced the most atrocious violence, who have lost everything. Their land have been stolen, their houses have been destroyed. They have nothing to go back to. What they want to see is accountability, is punition. I mean, they have a very different outlook on the conflict, which means that when you set forth policies, no matter what decision you make, some people will be happy and other people will be unhappy, which again, the recommendation becomes obviously to engage in the dialogue with the people so that there is some common agreement about what should be done and that people can support it. But if you impose it on them without discussing the options with them before, what's the likelihood that peace will last? In the end, the people are responsible and the people have the peace in their hands. I'll add one last example, which is something we're working on right now. There's kind of this common agreement that building memorials is a good thing. People have suffered. We should build memorials, museums, so that people can remember what has happened to them. Of course, it sounds very nice, but there are a category of people who actually don't want to be reminded of what they've experienced every day. Those who have trauma. Those who seeing something like that actually re-traumatize them every day. So what sounds like a good idea may actually hurt some people. And we have so many examples of that, whether it's accountability mechanisms, choices, some people support it, some people don't support it, whether it's how we build peace, whether it's, you have a much more complex society in front of you, so that those measures are actually very complex, and what sounds easy and doable is actually very difficult. I hope that answers it.
Indeed. How do you try to understand and explain the extreme neglect of and disregard for basic human needs and human rights, which seems to be such a large and painful part of the history of independent Africa?
I'll let you start.
That's a very small question, which should be easy to answer. Can you say that again?
Yes, well, obviously we see various degrees of neglect and disregard of human rights around the world, but it seems to stand out in various parts of Africa. What's the reason that there is such extreme neglect and disregard for those human rights in Africa?
I think that's hugely complicated. It makes me think of a film a friend of mine made called Continental Drift, where she asked the same kinds of people in Canada and Zimbabwe the same set of questions, and was really revealing and interesting. And an elderly lady in a Canadian shopping mall said, "I see those Africans on the television, I see them suffering, I see they're hungry, but they weren't always hungry. How did they live all these thousands of years up till now?" So I think it's a good question. And I think part of what the challenge of the book is to any audience is what is your country's role, and how does this work across globally? It's not, Zimbabwe isn't an entity on its own, and various of the stories relate to that and talk about the impact of economic, global economic policies and so on. I think the question that, or an issue that Patrick raised earlier about poverty is a huge point. I think we're talking about huge inequalities within countries and between countries and regions.
One of the things that came up again and again in the stories that the people we interviewed are talking about how, the power structure in Zimbabwe in particular, Mugabe and his henchmen, there's a small group of people getting very, very rich. This isn't that hard to understand on one level. And on the other level is how has it gone on for all these years? How has the government of Zimbabwe, and again, it's always uncomfortable, I think, for us to speak for the people in the book because they do such a wonderful job themselves. But to distill some of the things that people say is that the manipulation of politics, in particular in Zimbabwe, and that is, using colonialism, using in particular of late after 2000, the white farmers. One of the worst things that culminated in the violence of the 2000s in Zimbabwe was that land was not distributed after 1980. It was promised to be redistributed, and it wasn't. So land was closely held, a group of small white farmers who eventually lost their land in violence that was extrajudicial, let's say. The government just took it when they, you know, without particular process, and that's a whole long story, which again is told in the book. But all of this has to do with the fact that the government stays in power in various ways, and our people tell us how that happens. How to answer it for Africa in general, I don't think that that's appropriate, really. It's for us anyway.
I will add something to this, which is the what has been striking for me over the years working in the different countries is not how different, I mentioned earlier the heterogeneity, but beyond that, what's striking is how similar people are across countries, across continents. And pointing to Africa as the bad human rights student or situation ignores that not much further away than the prison system in California, we have tons of human rights violation. You have a teenager sentenced to prison without possibility of parole, sentenced to life without possibility of parole. I mean, this is, you know, you have human rights violations everywhere. You have perpetrators everywhere, and you have victims everywhere. The situation in Africa is more striking, probably because of the extent and because of the visibility of many of these violations. But I don't think that we should rank that as being worse, but it's definitely something of concern. That's the first part. The second part of the answer would be to really think about an example. If we take the forced conscription or the conscription of children in armed group in Africa, that is something that happens in many, many of the countries. It is hard for people to accept that this is a serious violation of humanitarian law, whereas children go to the field and work in the field, they fetch water every day. They work on a daily basis. Going into an armed group is just like another work. So understanding of those human rights and the context in which people live makes that the threshold of what's acceptable or not acceptable may be different, because that's just a question of perception. And so that goes to the question of education. And I mentioned earlier the situation of the education system in the Central African Republic. What will happen in 15 years when those kids who now enter school, who don't have proper teachers, become the adults, become the leaders of those countries? I mean, the few elite, of course, there is an elite that has access to the best schools and can go abroad to study, but the overall population does not. Most of the soldiers, the military, do not. So you have that old question, and in many ways, I see education as really the key to progress. So it's two parts of the answers, but and I think none of that really answered fully, but it's such a vast and complicated question.
All right, well, let's go back and focus for a moment on the Central African Republic. It sounds like a failed state. Zimbabwe does have the infrastructure. It was really one of the leading countries in Africa 25 years ago. And there's one can see some hope that if the power struggle were to end, it could be reconstructed in a relatively short period of time. But the CAR, as you've described it, seems almost impossible to envision a happy future for it. Can you talk about the optimistic side at all?
I have to confirm that, as far as I can tell, the CAR was never called the jewel of Africa, except perhaps from an environmental standpoint. I mean, it's a beautiful, definitely a beautiful country. I, in fact, thought the opposite about the Central African Republic. I mean, there's a lot of hopelessness, there's a lot of challenges, but at the same time, as the people mentioned, it is very much a conflict that is within the realm of politics. It is a question of leadership, a question of political pressure so that the fight for power stop. Whereas you have other conflicts that have very different dimensions where it's you have strong divides along ethnic lines, inheritance of privileges versus underprivileged. I mean, it's much, much more complicated to resolve. We can talk about the Congo or Liberia or other places. In the Central African Republic, to me, being there, actually, I was feeling that this actually should be a fairly straightforward conflict to resolve. You have to put pressure on those people to stop fighting. And that would be it. And it sounds kind of naive to say, but again, I see the issues as being so much less complicated than they are in other places where you have ethnic line divides, where you have decades of discrimination. That is not the case in the Central African Republic.
Well, that's hopeful. That's hopeful indeed. But we have brought this panel together just after the Ivorians from the Ivory Coast have closed their border. And they've closed their border because of a power struggle after about 10 years of fighting. And therefore, we might ask the question whether this isn't happening in several other countries at the same time. And I wonder if you would like to look at any other countries where there are parallels or have been parallels. Especially, you may want to talk about some of the countries where things have changed. Who'd like to speak first? Peter.
I've spent 2 years in Namibia, which is a wonderful country in southwestern Africa, and Namibia became independent in 1990, and I was there in 91 and 92, and it was a wonderful place to be. It was incredible to be in a place that had just become independent. I actually wrote a novel about that experience. In comparing that, because Namibia really looked at that time to Zimbabwe. Many cities in Namibia are called many streets in Namibia are called Robert Mugabe Avenue, and there's still a great deal of reverence for him in Namibia to this very moment. And I think that, you know, just as, and again, Zimbabwe is not going to be very easy to solve. It's true the infrastructure is there, but it's, you know, a lot of people are worried that after Mugabe dies, things are actually going to be worse. But just to make a comparison with Namibia, Namibia never makes the news. That was the big joke that we were there. We were very psyched when it would get on the BBC for sports because there was a famous boxer at the time. But Namibia has had slow land redistribution. Hasn't gone great, but it's going through a fairly normal process. South Africa has had some land redistribution. So looking to those countries and looking to how you might reconstruct Zimbabwe, you might take a cue from some of the things that are going on in South Africa and Namibia would be one place. You have experience in Botswana. Botswana is awfully peaceful.
Well, but these countries were never seen as violent. We can look, I think, more at Liberia. Before independence, indeed, it was in the middle of a war,
true,
of a conflict. But Liberia, Sierra Leone, Rwanda, South Africa were countries of great violence, mm-hmm. and they've changed. I wonder if you'd like to talk about anything that they have done that might be applicable to the countries that you've spoken about.
I think the question of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa is quite an interesting one. It's very contentious in the country. There's lots of critique about the fact that a great many violent crimes have been pardoned through this process, that a lot of people who should have been held accountable have gone free as a result. And also, interesting in terms of what Patrick was saying about Central African Republic, a lot of people feel that the victims whose lives and whole families have been destroyed have had nothing back, no material kind of reparations, whereas the whole process has been enormously expensive and so on. But having lived in South Africa through the period of the Truth Commission, I think what happened there was that It was on the news every day for 3 years. It was in the newspaper every day for 3 years. It was on television. Even if you were someone who tried not to listen or who switched it off, who went, oh, that again, and threw it, what it did was stamp it on the kind of, on the whole, on the consciousness of that country that these things had happened. And I think what, by contrast, in Zimbabwe, we had a reconciliation policy. But we, that sort of went, okay, we're all friends now, kind of thing. We won't talk about that. And at each stage, we would push things aside and not revisit them, not open the wounds, as it were. So I think the question that we try to do in our book, and that Patrick also talked about as an issue with the people you spoke with, of putting the truth on the table and actually all agreeing on some sequence of events, such as the kind of secret civil war in Zimbabwe between 83 and 87, Gukurahundi, between the government and the north of the country, sort of against the second liberation movement in the south of the country. 20,000 people are supposed to have died in that. And that was very much kept quiet and no one discussed it. And it was only released the report was only released many years later from a Catholic Justice Commission. So I think there's that element of bringing agreeing on the truth of some of the more painful aspects of the past.
Patrick?
It is sometimes disappointing for people to hear that, but unfortunately, nobody knows how to build a lasting peace. Nobody knows what the recipe is for security to return, for issues to be resolved so that a country moves forward. What works in one country does not necessarily work in another. What I thought I would mention in response to that question was really the regional dimension of many of these conflicts. In late 2005, 2006, the Lord's Resistance Army, which is a rebel group who was active in northern Uganda, withdrew its force from the country, and they mostly moved to Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Central African Republic. The Lord's Resistance Army had been active in northern Uganda for over 20 years, in the process committing many, many crimes, and we can discuss that further. But the point is that 90% of the population was displaced in camps, living in terrible conditions. 4 years later now, 90% of the people have returned home. They are rebuilding their lives. They are planting. They are harvesting. They are building. The economy has changed completely. But the Lord's Resistance Army is now in the Central African Republic, in the Sudan, and in the Congo, committing atrocious crimes in these areas. So what helps one country does not necessarily help the other. In the case countries that you mentioned, the only one that I know a little is Rwanda, having lived there about 3 years. And it's a little bit of the same, which is, sure, Rwanda has been doing some indicators well and some indicators pretty terrible. But certainly on the regional aspect, they have exported the war in the Congo. The crimes that have been committed in the Congo are just unacceptable. And so you can't consider Rwanda as a success as long as Burundi, as long as Congo are not stable. And of course, there's a lot to be said about the internal dynamic in Rwanda, about the recent elections, about freedom of press, about freedom of expression, about people being forced to move for urban planning purpose. I mean, there's many, many different type of violations that people who go to Kigali and see beautiful streets don't necessarily realize are going on. But that regional aspect is really what threatens many of these successes.
Thank you. Unfortunately, I'm running out of time. We have time perhaps for one last question with a couple of quick answers, and that is the United States doing in the two countries that you've discussed what it can and what it should? Who'd like to go first? Annie?
I think there's, in Zimbabwe, in relation to Zimbabwe, the U.S. has had a policy of very targeted sanctions against members of the ruling party and the government, which the success of that is arguable. what I hear from within Zimbabwe is that people wish that the US would lift those sanctions, because in the internal discourse, that's the government's excuse for economic collapse. The West is imposing sanctions. They're having limited effect, I'm sure, but whether that has any large impact, I'm not so sure.
It would be great if Zimbabwe was higher on the agenda in this country. From the leaked diplomatic cables, of which there were some from Zimbabwe, you get a sense of not really acute understanding of what's going on there, and that was unfortunate. So I think we should be more engaged and more involved. The diaspora is growing. It's a major, major crisis in the world, and we need to be paying more attention to it.
Patrick?
The problem is, if I put the Central African Republic a little higher on the agenda, then Zimbabwe goes down. And that's kind of the fight for that issue. What's happening in the CR, some of you may have heard of the Lord's Resistance Army Bill and the measures that are being taken to address that problem. The situation in Darfur as well have brought some attention to the Central African Republic. But overall, it still remains very isolated and forgotten country, and yet its neighbors, again, Sudan, the Congo, have some of the biggest crises that people have heard about. And this country is just tucked in the middle and is not only affected by what's happening in their neighboring countries, but also by their internal turmoil. So it's really a country that needs to be higher on the agenda, and we certainly hope that that will happen.
Well, I know the audience would like to say thanks. And I'd like to say thanks as well on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California. Thanks as well to the audience for your questions, and I'd like to remind you that Mrs. Holmes and Mr. Orner's book, Hope Deferred, is available for sale, courtesy of Books, Inc., and they will be available to sign copies here on stage. Thank you all, and good night.